Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we talk with a veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder who is encouraging other veterans with the symptoms to seek help. According to the Veterans Administration, they estimate its caseload of veterans suffering from PTSD is increasing by 20% a year. Well over 200,000 veterans are seeking treatment by the end of 2011, last year, and the VA believes that number is actually low, with many vets refusing treatment or going outside of the system. Post-traumatic stress disorder is characterized by flashbacks, nightmares, a state of hypervigilance, or emotional numbness. My guest today was familiar with all of those symptoms. Tom Skinner served in the military several decades ago, but found that he was suffering silently for years before finally acknowledging that he needed help. Today, he's currently riding his bicycle across the country with his service dog, Scrubs, to build awareness about this treatable condition and encourage other PTSD sufferers to get help. He joins us today as he's riding across the country. He'll be in Tulsa through Sunday doing bike rides and giving talks, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Tom Skinner, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're doing this cross-country ride to raise awareness of PTSD, and you know, you just have to watch television today. There's a major campaign to get veterans to acknowledge this issue, that veterans don't, I guess it's considered still a sign of weakness to seek help about these issues, but PTSD shows up in different ways. And in your case, it was some years after your Army service.
It was over 20 years after my service, and I was just doing a little reading this morning. And some statistics are saying that one out of every three veterans or military personnel that's going to be coming home will suffer some form of post-traumatic stress disorder. 2 years ago, in 2010, we had 450,000 new reported cases at the VA hospitals nationwide. Mm-hmm. And some of the problems that we're having with our returning vets is that we've trained them so well to be so strong, such good soldiers, that to say they're having a problem with what they just experienced and to come home and say, hey, I don't know how to deal with this, they feel like it's a sign of weakness, and it's not. I just bicycled from San Diego to Tulsa on my way to Vermont. That's not a sign of weakness. You won't catch me in a mall enjoying myself. You won't catch me in loud crowds and very hectic places. It bothers me still to this day. But I'm trying to lead by example and show that with the exercise that the bicycle gives me, 20 miles after starting my ride in the morning, the endorphins kick in and I'm a whole different person. And those are the kinds of things that I want to show people, is that, yes, you are going to have problems, but there's lots of help out there for you. It's not a weakness. I'm not weak. And the exercise is so helpful in my case.
Now, do you feel in your case that you were showing symptoms and you just didn't know what it was for a long time until, you know, an episode sort of brought it to your attention? Or
most definitely. Talking to my doctors after I was finally diagnosed with PTSD late 2010, we reviewed my last 20 years of what I've been doing and the withdrawals from society. I became a truck driver. I drove a semi-truck for over 1 million miles on our nation's highways. I lived in my semi.
Then you became a wildlife photographer, and again, that's a very solitary pursuit.
After my truck driving career ended due to some back injuries, things like that, I found myself in the desert filming the bighorn sheep in San Diego County, to living in the middle of nowhere in Alaska, spending lots of time with grizzly bears, to Yellowstone, to all of our national parks. So yeah, I did withdraw a lot. I had no idea that I was suffering from PTSD, and that was my symptoms. And even friends and family at church, once they finally had this diagnosis, and I finally had this diagnosis, there was so many, oh, it all makes sense now. Things finally are put into place. I just thought that, you know, I didn't like people, but it wasn't that at all. It really was bothering me, and I had no idea what was going on. And dealing with the doctors and talking with the VA hospital, they really help you sort out these problems. And we're bringing our troops home physically, but we need to bring them home mentally too. Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to do, is help these guys. They owe it to themselves, they owe it to their families to go get this help that's available for them. It's not an easy process. They are very overwhelmed at several VA hospitals. The waiting list can be weeks to even several months.
And I think one of the issues with our returning veterans now is that you're seeing an awful lot of National Guard troops, not regular Army, not regular armed services.
That's correct.
That are functioning every bit as much. I don't want to make any separation there. They're doing the work of regular armed services, but they're the citizen soldiers in our Guard. And so they go over, spend 18 months. They probably have some treatment plans in the military, but you know, once they come home, pretty soon they're back right on the job or they're back into their civilian life. I would think that makes it even more difficult to get a handle on this.
It is. And while you're deployed overseas, you have everyone wearing the same color uniform. You have that support, that brotherhood and that sisterhood, that unit that you're with. And then when you come home back to the States or wherever you're coming from, most of the active military are back on a post somewhere where they still have that sense of belonging. And we used to call it going back to Fort Living Room, where it's not quite Fort wherever you're from. In Fort Living Room, you don't have the backup. You don't have the friends to lean on. You don't have the people that understand where you've been. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely hard for a lot of those people to be forced back into civilian life and not have that that support group that is available for some of our active duty people. So that's one thing that we really have to consider. And we're not talking just guys. We have mothers out there. We have single mothers. We have families that are in the military. Don't forget about our women veterans. They saw the same things.
Yeah. Now, one of the things we've found from this last decade of conflict is that there's finally been a growing awareness by the military establishment of how many people this affects. Have we seen changes in the way the VA and the way about how returning vets are counseled on these issues? Or is there still some places where vets don't want to talk about this?
Oh, I agree in both ways. There's a lot of places where vets just don't want to talk about it yet because they are afraid of losing a promotion. They're afraid of being scrutinized for being weak. And there's just a whole lot of problems in this system as far as just receiving the help and convincing these people it's not a weakness. And that's what I have run across more than anything through my website and emails is I have this, but I don't know what to do about it. I don't know how to talk about it. I don't want to lose my family. I don't want to lose a promotion. Those types of things that we've just got to – they even have a campaign, excuse me, that's called It Takes the Courage of a Soldier to Ask for Help. And for me, when I first asked for help – it was extremely embarrassing. It was extremely hard. And when they put a name to what I had, what was going on, it was even worse.
You felt stigmatized?
I very felt stigmatized. I withdrew even more. I spent a lot of time at home, not leaving my house for several months except for to go to my doctor appointment at the VA every Friday. Besides that, I didn't leave the home.
May I ask you what you were doing at home? Just vegging out?
What I was doing at home was I was reading everything I could about what PTSD is. I was spending a lot of time at the National Center for PTSD's website trying to figure out, is this thing treatable? Am I going crazy? Am I losing my mind? What's going on with me? And I would tweet about this and share my resources that I found on my Facebook page, on a couple different websites that I had put together, to Twitter. And what I'd come up with after a while was, this is treatable, but I need to do more than just sit at home and talk about this. If I'm going to be miserable at home with PTSD, I need to make a difference in not just my life, but in the lives of these returning veterans. And I wasn't going to hide anymore. I need to go out and tell people my story and tell them that this is treatable. I may not be able to change a lot of my past, but I can maybe change the future for some of our returning veterans. And then when I finally received my service dog for PTSD. Her name is Scrubs. She's a border collie. She's about 4 years old now.
She's being very quiet here in this room here.
Yes. She most of the time when I'm at dinner or someplace like that and all of a sudden she makes her appearance when it's time to leave, everyone's startled. We didn't know you had an animal with you. So, yes, she's very well trained. But she's made a huge difference in my life.
Can you talk about how the difference the service dog has made?
Well, just for beginners, I have now something that I have to take care of. She relies on me for her food, for her walking, to go outside. And so it kind of forced me to begin with just to get out and participate a little bit.
Yeah, to get you out of this isolation. Uh-huh.
We have some breathing techniques. You're going to tell most people if they're talking to a psychologist or psychiatrist about some anxieties, they're going to say things like, well, you know what, you need to close your eyes. Let's count to 10 and take a deep breath. You're not going to find too many guys that are going to do that in a mall or out in public when they're having anxiety problems. So we have some really neat techniques that I can do if I'm having lots of anxiety and I'm now getting this attention that I really don't want on me. We have a breathing technique where she'll stand completely still and I can make her take one step at a time. And people then go from, are you okay, to, wow, cool dog. And it takes the attention off of me and on to her. She's trained to get me outside of buildings when I'm having some problems. But the biggest thing is...
Does she sense your anxiety level?
That's what I wanted to say. The biggest thing that she does for me is she catches my anxiety level before I even do. I've been upset a little bit, and I've had a few tears during this radio show, but she is such a smart dog that that's not her style. It's when she feels the anxiety and I'm really starting to panic. Mm-hmm. That's when she jumps up on top of me. She gives me little scratches, that type of thing, and says, hey, calm down, focus. This is what's happening. Remember, everything's fine. And just that sense of watching my back really gives me great relief.
I was reading on your blog about how, you know, since these episodes escalated, you said, you know, one of the things is night terrors of waking up and having bad dreams, nightmares, and with the dog there, you know, when you wake up, you know that what you're experiencing is an internal sensation as opposed to an external sensation by where the dog is. If the dog is asleep, and that gives you a sense of security.
Correct. The last year of my military service, I spent in Hampton Roads doing funeral details. I had the honor of laying our soldiers to rest.
So your honor guard.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one thing that bothers me the most. And I can hear that 21-gun salute still to this day. It's something, and I can even smell the gunpowder and that type of thing. And I used to wake up a lot, not knowing if what was just happening was real. I felt like I was still there again. I could feel the temperature, everything. And my dog is such a, I guess you'd call it a scaredy cat. She jumps at everything, which is exactly what I need. She doesn't jump and run. She jumps and faces it. So when I wake up in the middle of the night, first thing I do, if I look at her and she's sound asleep and laying down the floor like she is right now, I know what happened, what I thought happened, is not real, and it's my job to calm myself back down and get back to sleep. But if she is awake, then I know, hey, something did happen, and okay, let's go check this out. But that was one problem that I really had with my sleeping was this real? I just did not know if it was real or not, and she has really changed my life when it comes to my sleeping habits.
My guest today is Tom Skinner, a veteran and wildlife photographer. He is currently traveling cross-country on bicycle to raise awareness about PTSD, and his website is understandingptsd.org. And you speak to a lot of groups about this. Was that difficult to do for the first time?
For the very first time, it was extremely difficult because I spoke to my church, the people that have known me since I was 2 or 3 years old. And it's like telling all your friends your deep, dark secret. And it was very hard. But it was also one of the best things I could have ever done because the support and love that I've got from those people have really made this whole thing possible for me right now. And the encouragement that I get is just amazing.
Now, is this journey therapeutic for you in any way? Or is I would think talking about this all the time, it may be good, but it can also be stressful at times.
It's extremely stressful. But one of the therapies that I was involved with in the VA in San Diego was called exposure therapy, where you talk about these things. And there's still quite a few things I have not talked about at all. But one thing is just getting out and being in public. It started with just a small walk in the neighborhood to now I'm talking to groups all over the country.
And you're talking to strangers.
I'm talking to strangers. But I used to just break down and cry and sob during my presentations. And now it's a lot easier to talk about. It's still very hard. It's still extremely scary, but it's not about me. It's about the 450,000 other veterans that are out there that you can't pick up a newspaper or watch TV without reading something about PTSD. And when I read these things, I know how these people feel. I know how PTSD destroys lives. It destroys communities, families. And It's something I have to do. It's almost like I don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm. I would think in the course of your travels, and you've been traveling mostly around Route 66, you kind of made a few detours in the last few weeks, met a lot of people, probably people who've known veterans or are veterans and sort of in the same boat.
I have run across a lot of veterans. I don't know if there's too many people that I haven't run into that have not been affected or know somebody that has PTSD. It's been hard. It's been very hard. I can see pain in a lot of veterans' eyes when they're also thanking me. They're on board. They're like, you have to continue doing this. And it's their support and just meeting them and seeing their faces. And when they see the sign that says understandingptsd.org on my side of my bicycle, I see people making beelines for me. They've read that and there's nothing stopping them. They have to come talk to me and find out what's going on. And I just brace myself because I know what's coming next. And when it's over with, it's a little bit easier every single time. And I feel good being able to share just some of the resources that I have found through the VA and talking to people along the way that I keep putting them on my website. Mm-hmm. So there's any resources, just keep checking the website, and there's always going to be something new.
We might think that the VA is overwhelmed in these cases, and it may be at times difficult to get an appointment. Once you get into the system, is the care good in your experience?
The care is very good in the VA. It's like I used to tell everyone, it's not the VA your grandpa used to know. This VA has changed a lot. Some of the reading that I've done, they're actually looking to hire another 1,900 people in these psychiatric field, whether it's doctors and therapists to all kinds of people that are supporting the PTSD. They are definitely aware of how backed up they are, and I can't say enough about how good I was treated at the VA hospital. There are a lot of frustrations. There's a lot of red tape. There's a lot of hurry up and wait, just like in the military, but there's 450,000 of them just in 2010. Where do you think we're all going to go? We have to just wait. And what I'm doing along the way is I'm talking to churches and civic organizations and just different communities and giving them some ideas of what we can do to take care of our veterans while they are waiting in that line. We can offer them a safe place that they can come hang out. Some of the churches can offer different events that we can just invite them in and get them to come and experience.
But as you well know from your own experience, being around strangers is probably the last thing you want to do.
It really is.
Yeah. Although I imagine everybody is a little different in that regard, too. And that's the other thing. And the other thing we haven't talked about is you have PTSD, and then you have traumatic brain injuries of varying degrees, everything from mild concussions on up. And this complicates matters even greater.
Thankfully, I do not suffer from any kind of TBI, traumatic brain injury. But there are a lot of traumatic brain injuries out there that, so they're suffering from PTSD, plus they have lost quite a bit of their mental faculties. They're just not quite sure.
Or then they're not really sure. They're not as sharp as they once were, but they don't know necessarily the reason, because it was diagnosed as a concussion or something like that, which until these wars, we always thought a concussion was something that affected you for a week or two and went away.
Now it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
And PTSD, they keep asking me, well, is this treatable? Will it ever go away? I don't know if it's going to go away. But what I do know is I am managing my PTSD so much better than I was just 15 months ago. 15 months ago, I won't lie, there was many thoughts of suicide. There was many thoughts of, I just want it to go away. I just want it to stop. I just had to have some sort of relief. And now, with the physical exercise that I do, I have recovered leaps and bounds from just a few short months ago. And that's what I'm trying to share with other people is exercise and talking and going to therapy. And this is not a weakness. Come all the way home. Get the help that you need.
And I should point out that I've heard from so many stories where this goes undiagnosed for a while. And maybe people can manage it for a number of years. You lived with this situation for what, 20 years?
22 years.
22 years. And it can be a triggering event. It can be everything from anesthesia. And all of a sudden, these experiences are like they were yesterday.
Exactly correct. I did not know I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder for the last 20 years, and I had been to a military funeral recently where I was actually involved, and I helped participate in folding the flag. And just from talking to the doctors, we believe that that was probably my trigger. Once your cup is full, it's just full. And that was the day that things started to change for me, and I started to have problems and nightmares and flashbacks. And it was 22 years later when this started to happen. So you may think that you have everything under control, but sooner or later it can come full circle. So you need to get that help. You need to just go talk to someone and share what's going on.
My father was a World War II veteran. Of course, he came home, went on with his life, and he had heart surgery in his 60s after he came out of anesthesia. These memories came flooding back, and he was debilitated for a number of months. And he was unfortunately that generation which, you know, I'm going to get on with my life, and he sort of compartmentalized. But this is a big issue for not only our returning Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans, but from the first Gulf War, from military interventions in Vietnam and earlier. This is still an issue, and even if it hadn't shown up, you never know when it will.
And there's no telling what the trigger may be. It could be something as much as a smell, to the temperature, to a noise. It could be just about anything. We just don't know what those triggers can be.
Well, yeah. you're on your way, about halfway there, going to Vermont. You're speaking to groups along the way, but when you reach that destination, what are your feelings about that?
Well, National Center for PTSD has been such a big part of my life from the very beginning of this whole ordeal. I feel like it was almost my finish line. They're going to be having a big celebration at the VA hospital. They're going to be having a bike ride. They are expecting me to show up there. But when I'm done with this, I have many plans to continue with the bicycle ride and also to start sharing this form of exercise and bicycling with other veterans to get them involved and get them out. And you'll hear more about that in the months to come.
No, you were a wildlife photographer prior, I guess, to really these triggers occurring.
Correct, and I still am. I still love my wildlife.
So you think you're going to keep doing that?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. That is my absolute joy and my passion. Besides my 2-year-old daughter, Courtney, I just love my wildlife photography, from grizzly bears to the bighorn sheep to just ladybugs. When it comes to the wildlife, I just can't get enough.
Yeah. Now, I know you've been surprised by Oklahoma, haven't you?
I have, in so many ways. The people of Oklahoma have been, this is not the Oklahoma I expected. They have been so warm and welcoming, and this is called the Green Belt. I guess that's that
what
we call that?
Green Country.
Green Country. I was not expecting it to be this green. But yeah, I love.
Wait till August, though.
Yeah, hopefully I will be sitting back in San Diego in August, maybe photographing the bighorn sheep out there. But yes, I've really enjoyed Oklahoma so far.
All right. Well, we wish you great success. The website is understandingptsd.org. Best of luck to you and Scrubs on your journey. Safe journey, because I know your highways and bikes don't always mix. But we wish you great success. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Skinner is a veteran wildlife photographer and is currently riding cross-country to raise awareness about PTSD with his service dog, Scrubs. You can learn more about his journey at understandingptsd.org. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
I was lolling in bed one Sunday morning, listening to the radio and trying not to open my eyes or get up, when I heard Abby Lincoln singing Up Jumped Spring. That's all it took. Within minutes, I was sitting in my backyard with a cup of coffee and the papers. This is what I look forward to all year. This is why I spend every penny and every free minute working in my garden, so I can have spring mornings like this. The rest of the year, I roar through life in high gear, barely hanging on to the earth as it hurtles and tilts and spins through space, but suddenly, up jumps spring. The first section I read in the local paper is the obituaries. All too often there's somebody I know, and that obit comes like a little starburst of pain. Oh, he was so funny. Or, I'm glad she had a good life. Strange word, obituary. From a Latin root, variously translated as death, departure, going to meet, or to fall. But since the 1700s, obituary has meant a notice of death. Not that you would know it from the paid obituaries written by the deceased families or loved ones, especially the religious among us, who search for comforting euphemisms such as gone to his heavenly Father, or has been called home, sleeping in the bosom of Jesus, or now wears angel wings. Now, this is comical to me as an Episcopalian because I'm accustomed to the unsentimental realism of the funeral service in the Book of Common Prayer. It has the poetic but blunt sentence, "In the midst of life, we are in death." Although I saw a question about that on the internet that was unintentionally but riotously funny, a woman asked, "What does that phrase mean, in the midst of life, we are in debt?" Not debt, Rosanna Dana, death. Still, the word death is being edged farther and farther away from our mainstream vocabulary. Even some newspapers that were once the standard bearers of good English usage now substitute the word past for death. Past is a word I associate with a kid named Rollo I went to school with. Rollo was always in danger of being held back a grade, and we all liked Rollo, so every year at the end of the school term, we'd ask one another anxiously, "Did Rollo pass?" I'm not the first to notice that as people fall away from organized religion with its ceremonies, we so crave ceremony that we invent new ones. We build makeshift shrines at the site of automobile crashes. We pile flowers and mementos at the location of tragedies. And we rewrite funeral services, or cobble together new ones with a personal twist. An Anglican priest in England lamented publicly recently how today's bereaved reject the traditional hymns. He said the songs they request most frequently are "I Did It My Way," or, even more curious, "Nobody Does It Better." And so, in the midst of life is death. And even in the midst of spring comes calamity. My cat Jessie caught a cold. Sneezing, eyes running, stuffy nose. I apologize up front for sounding sexist, but I must report that he took it like a man, which means he went to bed for 3 days, slept on a pillow, and I fetched him his meals on a tray. All is well now. The cat is healthy. Only strangers listed in the obituary column today. And as a cherry on a sundae, I have a new pair of yellow shoes. That's what life is like when up jumps spring.
Connie Cronley is a local writer and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. That's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.